Thanks for joining us. I'm Sabri Benishore with Marketplace, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's on a station visit to WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Donald Trump clinches enough delegates to claim the Republican nomination. A State Department review criticizes Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server. And 11 states sue the federal government over a transgender bathroom directive. Joining me for the domestic hour of the Friday News Roundup, Chris Freitz of CNN, Laura Meckler of The Wall Street Journal, and David Rennie of The Economist. Thanks, all of you, for coming.
That's wonderful to be here.
Nice to be here.
So the AP said yesterday that Donald Trump has clinched the Republican nomination. How did he respond to that?
He said he was honored. He was very honored to receive it. It was not a surprise, obviously. He has no more no more competition. And the reason a lot of people may wonder, how did he clinch on a day where we didn't have any actual elections?
Yeah.
And the way that happened, that AP and CNN and these other big news organizations were able to call this race, is we have been tracking all the delegates. And there were a number of unbound delegates. These were delegates who didn't have to declare an allegiance to one candidate or the other. And we're calling them, and then we found that there were enough delegates who now saying that they are going to support Donald Trump, that he, you know, clinched that nomination, got to that magic number of 1237. And important to remember, though, of course, he's still the presumptive Republican nominee until those delegates actually vote on the floor in July. But certainly, you know, he is, by all intents and purposes, the nominee here.
Yeah, but that's what we call it, presumptive, right? And he kind of reveled in the fact that Hillary has not yet clinched her nomination.
I mean, that's sort of the irony of this whole thing. Who would have thought just even 4 months ago, three or four months ago, that essentially the Democrats would still be fighting over this and the Republicans would have it all wrapped up? It was absolutely predicted to be the other way around. Now, Hillary Clinton is not quite the presumptive nominee, but she is the odds-on favorite nominee. Now, Bernie Sanders is still campaigning hard, and his followers are extremely loyal to him. And he's out there telling people that he can still win this. But truthfully, if you look at the math, it was very, very difficult for him to take this nomination from her, both because she's so far ahead in terms of pledge delegates. Those are the ones chosen by voters. And she's way far ahead in terms of super delegates. Those are the 700 party leaders and elected officials who get to vote for whoever they like.
In fact, by CNN's math, it's impossible for Bernie Sanders to clinch the nomination with the number of pledge delegates that are left. So he needs to convince those super delegates, which Hillary Clinton has about 500 of them. Bernie Sanders has just 40 of them. So he needs to convince a huge number to flip. And in order to do that, he'd have to be winning more contests. I mean, if you look at 2008, when Barack Obama was able to flip some of Hillary Clinton's super delegates, that's because he was beating Hillary Clinton by about 100 pledged delegates, which is less than what Hillary Clinton is leading Bernie Sanders by now, and only about 30 or so flip. So it's a really tough road for Bernie Sanders.
Yeah. Well, what do you think? I mean, reporters keep pointing this out to Sanders, as they do to every primary candidate who's behind. What does he say? I mean, what's his
rationale for keeping going for believing that he has a path? He himself says he has every right to fight to the end of the last primary.
So it's
his people point out that in 2008, when Hillary Clinton was competing against Barack Obama, she didn't drop out before the primaries were over. What is really interesting is that if you go to Bernie Sanders' rallies, as I have done, I'm sure all of us have done recently, and you talk to the people there, there is a real division in the crowd. There are people who identify themselves as Bernie or bust. They talk about writing his name in on the ballot or voting for Jill Stein, the Green Party nominee for president. And they say they cannot imagine ever voting for Hillary Clinton. It's only anecdote. I'm not a pollster, but when I go and talk to as many people as I can, I make a point of asking them, would you like Bernie Sanders to destroy Hillary Clinton, to throw everything that he possibly could at her in order to try and get those last superdelegates? And I would say more than half of the people that I talk to tend to say, no, I don't like Hillary Clinton, but then they bring up Donald Trump. And I know we're interested in talking about Bernie Sanders. I don't want us to forget how important this moment is of Donald Trump getting this nomination. And it's not just a set of numbers. This is the moment when Republican politicians, many of whom have said to journalists like us in the past how worried they are by Donald Trump, how they think he is not a conservative, that he is appealing to bigotry, that he has a problem with telling the truth, that he is not fit for high office, that he is a pathological liar, to quote Senator Ted Cruz of Texas. Mm. For a long time, they could think, well, maybe something will come up. Maybe he won't be the nominee. Maybe there's some way of stopping him. This week is the week that those hopes disappeared. Something will not come up. Well, he is going to be the nominee, and now they all have to choose what they're going to do about that.
Marco Rubio just released his delegates to Trump.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How is the is it fair to say the Republican establishment is sort of coming around to him, the exception of Paul Ryan?
I actually don't know that they're coming around to him. I think what they're trying to grapple with is an idea of, you know, how close do we get to him? I mean, certainly, Mitch McConnell, Mitch McConnell, of course, is Senate Republican majority leader. There has been some movement around them. They're kind of forced to get behind him now because it's either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. But the question is really, how close do they get? With Paul Ryan, not endorsing yet, he is trying to get some kind of policy concessions out of Donald Trump. He wants to come and say, Donald Trump's on our team. He's going to push for things like lower taxes. And, certainly they disagree on things like trade and immigration. So he's trying to find some middle ground to protect his members and say, Donald Trump has, the Republican Party's interest at heart. Because remember, he's not necessarily a Republican. In fact, he gave to Democratic candidates. He gave to Hillary Clinton. And he also was somebody who was pro-life, not too long ago. He was essentially a New York Democrat.
So, Laura, what do you think?
Well, I think the establishment definitely is coming around to Donald Trump, but not all of them, but a lot of them, much more than I think a lot of people predicted. But perhaps more importantly, the voters seem to be coming around to him. I mean, for a long time during the primaries, people were saying, well, yes, he's got 40% of the Republican primary voters. But, that's just because the field is so large and, really more people are against him than for him. But if you look at what's happened in the polling, he has consolidated Republican support behind him. And that's important going into the fall. Now, that doesn't mean he's going to win, but it means that he starts where he needs to start.
Mm-hmm. So moving on to Hillary Clinton and her debate future. She declined to debate Bernie Sanders before the California primary on June 7th. But Sanders may have found another debate partner. Tell us about that.
Well, it's kind of funny because, so Trump is on Jimmy Kimmel Live, and evidently ahead of the show, they asked Bernie Sanders, what's the one question you would like to ask him? And, in a moment of pure self-interest, he says the question is, well, will you debate me? And so, Trump says, yeah, sure, it'll be great. It'll be wonderful. Amazing. More people will watch it. We could raise money for charity. And then Sanders said, all right, let's do it. Now, so then Trump was asked again, and he says he'll do it if a network can put up $10 million to go to charity. He'll do it.
$10 to $15 million.
But here's the thing, is that if you really look at, who would this be good for? Who would this be bad for? This would be great for Bernie Sanders. It elevates him.
Right.
And, it helps him show Democrats what he would look like if he were the nominee. But I don't see how this is good for Donald Trump in any way.
I think it is good for Donald Trump, actually. I think it gives him a test run against Democrats. It gets him to be able to show that he can throw punches.
I think your network would love it if he did it on your network. I think that the idea Bernie Sanders would likely come out with both barrels at Donald Trump.
Well,
I don't think it would necessarily go very well.
We know who it'd be bad for. We know who it'd be bad for is Hillary Clinton.
And so many Democrats
are getting increasingly furious with Bernie Sanders because he appears to be on essentially an ego kick. If you're a sort of card carrying Democrat who does not seem to mind what he's going to do to the likely nominee of the party.
But I also think that's overblown. This whole idea that somehow he's dividing the party, it was much more divisive in 2008 with Clinton versus Obama. There were, in South Carolina, there was, charges that the Clintons were becoming racist. That was a much tighter race, a much nastier race, and they came together, and she ended up serving.
There's some important differences now between 2008 and this year, and I think that it's very possible, probably likely, that they'll come together again this time. But what in 2008, Hillary Clinton had her own political future to think of, which Bernie Sanders presumably is not running for president again. Hillary Clinton was also a creature of the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders is not a creature of the Democratic Party. Now, they both
wanted...
Well,
neither was Donald Trump, and they're coming around to Donald Trump on the Republican side.
Right, they're coming around to him. But the question is, does Bernie Sanders have an interest of the party in terms of unifying around Hillary? And I don't think he has those same interests if he's defeated that Hillary had in 2008. That said, I do think that ultimately it's hard to look at the big picture from when you're in the middle of it. And I think that ultimately all the signs are that once the primaries are over, even though he says he's taking this fight to the convention, chances are that they will work something out.
I think that's right.
Well, but back to this debate and how much popcorn I should buy.
Yeah.
Is it going to happen? I mean, do you really think that
I think it's unlikely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what Hillary's been saying, too. She said,
She's hoping. She says it's just a joke, but she's probably right.
Unless somebody's got $10 million bucks.
Yeah. Well, who knows? So there was a State Department Inspector General report that was critical of Hillary Clinton's use of a personal email server while she was Secretary of State. What did that report say?
It was very bad news for Hillary Clinton. I mean, she has been saying for over a year now that she followed all the rules, that she did nothing wrong. And that State Department Inspector General report, which is essentially the independent watchdog for the State Department, said, actually, there were rules and she broke those rules. In fact, she didn't even ask for anybody to advise her on the rules. Now, the Clinton folks have said, you know, this is very much, something that other secretaries of state have done. But this is a big problem for Hillary Clinton.
And coming up, more of the Friday News Roundup. You can see all of our guests on a live video stream at drshow.org. We'll be right back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. I'm Sabri Benishore with Marketplace, sitting in for Diane Rehm. With me is Chris Freites. He's an investigative correspondent with CNN. David Rennie is Washington bureau chief and columnist at The Economist. And Laura Meckler, she's national political correspondent at The Wall Street Journal. And if you're just joining us, you can also watch live video of our show at drshow.org. So when we left, we were talking about Clinton emails. Laura, you had something to say about that.
Who doesn't have something to say about the Clinton emails? I mean, it's a subject I think that will go down in history as one of our great moments. No, I don't know. I think that the Inspector General report was definitely bad for Hillary Clinton in that it brought more attention to the issue and it made it clear that she was not in compliance with the guidelines. That said, I think we've kind of known all along that she wasn't in compliance with the rules and the guidelines that were in place at the time. And the information the Inspector General's report brought was a little more nuanced. For instance, it uncovered an email that we didn't know existed that where she was talking about her own concerns about her personal stuff becoming public, which I think sheds light on what her motives probably really were in setting this up in the first place.
That she didn't want her personal.
Yeah, she didn't want her personal private business. Didn't want any chance that it would become public. I think that was probably part of her motivation. That email that for some reason had never showed up made that clear. And also, the Inspector General report made it clear that she was supposed to ask for permission to set it up this way, and she had not done that.
It sounds very much like an ask for forgiveness rather than permission situation.
I do think that the basic facts of the email situation have been known for a long time, and I don't think that this report changed our basic understanding of what happened.
Now, just really quick for all the listeners out there, we're going to do an entire show on this next week, so tune in.
You could definitely do a whole show.
David, go ahead.
Let me just make a kind of electoral point here, though, which is I entirely agree with both the other guests in terms of, you know, it's bad, but put it in context, it doesn't tell us anything we didn't already kind of know. In the political terms, I think you have 40% roughly of the electorate on each side where it's all baked in. You know, you go to a Trump rally, people say she should be in jail. and, you know, that's they're not going to change their mind. This isn't going to make them feel she should go to jail more. Then you have a whole bunch of people on the Democratic side who are so appalled by Donald Trump that unless Hillary Clinton is kind of indicted and led off in handcuffs, this isn't going to affect their view. But I do still think it matters because, you know, who may decide this election? You know, if you have to guess now, sitting in May, late May, it's people like suburban mothers in the collar counties of Philadelphia, the collar counties of Denver, people who voted for Obama in 08, voted for Romney in 2012, the very few swing voters there are in this electorate who live in battleground states. And we know, you know, who these people are. We know that where they live in the country, there's not many of them. But if they look at this and they go, ah, you know, that sounds a bit official. That just, you know, this reconfirms everything I don't like about her. That has consequences, I think. So, you know, there are so few people available to be persuaded. This stuff does matter if it sways some of them.
She does point out that this is not that different from what previous secretaries of state have done, right?
Well, she continues to try to conflate those things.
It's really one previous secretary of state, first of all.
Yeah, it is one secretary of state, and, you know, Colin Powell had used personal email. He didn't have a personal private server that he routed everything through. And I think it's important. There's a couple things that this report told us that we didn't know before. That she failed to seek legal approval, and had she, it wouldn't have been allowed because of the security risk. We also found out that when people inside the State Department tried to raise this with top aides, they said, quote, never speak of the secretary's personal email again. So there was a feeling there that we're not going to even talk about this because it might be wrong. And I think the other thing to point out is all the other past Secretary of State cooperated with this Inspector General report. She refused to be interviewed. All her top aides refused to be interviewed. And to David's point about trustworthiness, I don't think most of the electorate cares is going to get into the weeds about the nitty gritty of her email use. But it goes to that bigger idea of trustworthiness. And she's underwater in those ratings. People find her more, they don't trust her more than they trust her. And this only goes to that narrative. And she continues to say that it was allowed, when the fact of the matter is, if she had asked, it wouldn't have been allowed.
Right. It wasn't expressly disallowed because it wasn't asked about. David.
Just very briefly, I think the other thing that, you know, is a sort of an end of yarn that people will be tugging at now in this kind of tangled ball is the revelation, I think we didn't know before, that her home server had been attacked. We have quotes in the Inspector General's report from the technical advisor who she hired, the private technician, saying, I had to shut the server down today because we were attacked again, so it'll be down for a bit. I mean, I think if down the road we discover that the Chinese or someone got into this server, you know, there's no evidence of that at the moment, but that's a real potential area of vulnerability, I think.
Yes.
Now, all this overshadowed what Hillary would have preferred to talk about, which was her pledge to boost spending on infrastructure in her first 100 days. What did she want to talk about?
Well, you know what? I mean, I was with her this week in California where she made that announcement. It frankly wasn't much of an announcement. She said she would introduce a plan within the first 100 days. She said it would be bigger, huge. It would be bigger than anything since the interstate highway system was created in the 50s. But she didn't explain how much money she wanted to spend or what it would be. She said those details are coming. So it was kind of a little bit of a shell of an announcement, if you ask me, definitely overshadowed. Frankly, her main message in California was really not about infrastructure spending. It was really about Donald Trump. And she just went after him hard on a string of issues. Her stump speech has been turned over almost completely to a takedown of Donald Trump on just a wide range of issues, everything from his stuff he said about foreign policy to immigration to his tax returns. And it's to the big story they pushed this week, which was that ahead of the housing crisis, Donald Trump appeared to be rooting for the bubble to burst so that he could kind of swoop in and make some money off of it. That was their real main message of the week. They did have the infrastructure thing, but I think that was the anti-Trump message is what they were really pushing.
And the infrastructure went back to November. I mean, she rolled that out. It was a $250 billion plan that she says she wants to fix roads.
But now she's promising to do it within the first 100 days.
Within the first 100 days. And that was the difference. But I think it also highlights what Hillary Clinton wants to do in this campaign. She wants to talk about policy. She's a policy wonk, and that's where she's most comfortable. And Donald Trump wants to not talk about policy at all and wants to continue to hit her to keep her off balance. And as Laura points out, you're starting to see how she's reacting to that. You know, she wants to, you know, as her camp always says, run an issue-based campaign. However, she's spending a lot of her stump speech attacking Donald Trump.
And in fairness, that's an advantage to Trump. Some of those attacks are issue-based. Some of them are less so. But some of it is actually about the issues. When you listen to her talk about immigration policy, for instance, is he going to round up people and deport them? When talked about foreign policy, are we going to allow the spread of nuclear weapons? Are we going to get out of NATO? I mean, these are things that are truly policy-based and some less so.
But also, go ahead.
Infrastructure is not an accident that she chose it. Now, it can be dull to think about. But why infrastructure is an interesting policy is it's one of the very few policies where Sanders supporters love to hear about all those hard hat jobs being created by the federal government building new roads and bridges and stuff. That appeals to Sanders supporters. It's also, if you're Hillary Clinton and you are trying to peel away moderate pro-business Republicans who are appalled by Donald Trump, you know, I work for The Economist. We talk to a lot of business leaders. One of the things that they say all the time is this country's infrastructure is in a terrible state. It's appalling that Congress hasn't gotten on with infrastructure. So if you're trying to peel away sort of moderate business Republicans, infrastructure is a really good subject to talk about.
It looks like she has, Clinton has sort of started to farm out some of the nasty campaigning to surrogates like Elizabeth Warren. I'll just read you what Elizabeth Warren said. She said, where is it? She called him a money grubbing.
She saw a small money grubbing man who's greedy and only has that in mind. And basically, she's trying to audition for the VP role here. Well, I mean, that's what it feels like to me.
I have no idea if she wants to be vice president or not, and neither does probably anybody else in this room. I don't think that those attacks were farmed out to Elizabeth Warren. I think Elizabeth Warren exists very much apart from the Clinton campaign.
Sure. Yeah.
She is, I think, genuinely horrified by Donald Trump. If she was auditioning for vice president, she probably would have snuck in something positive to say about Hillary Clinton, which she didn't even mention Hillary Clinton. Mm. She hasn't endorsed Hillary Clinton. She didn't say anything about Sanders either. But she, I think, is genuinely horrified by the idea of Donald Trump being president, and she has decided she's going to go after him with everything she's got.
Can I just point out, so on the Elizabeth Warren thing briefly, we need to keep reminding ourselves we're getting normalized to Donald Trump and how offensive he is. But Donald Trump this week has been talking about Elizabeth Warren as Pocahontas. In reference to her, you know, whether she does or doesn't have Native American ancestry, says she has a big mouth. Imagine if Ted Cruz was the nominee and suddenly out of the blue he'd said, Elizabeth Warren, Pocahontas, she has a big mouth. We'd be having a big discussion about whether that's offensive.
Or imagine if he'd used a different, racial or ethnic group.
And this is not right. It's not normal. This shouldn't be the discourse in politics. And I don't want this country to become normalized to it.
And to David's point, I mean, we're also seeing him dredge up all of the Bill Clinton sexual misconduct and trying to tie that to Hillary Clinton by saying, you know, she helped tear down these women who were bringing these allegations. He brought up Whitewater. He brought up the right-wing conspiracy theories about Vince Foster's death, who was ruled a suicide by a bunch of different investigations.
Yeah.
And, you know, it feels like an episode of I Love the 90s. And that's kind of what you're seeing here, and that's why to see somebody like Elizabeth Warren come in, who, as Laura points out, has not endorsed Hillary Clinton, in fact, is the heir apparent to Bernie Sanders' movement among the progressive groups and is really kind of, you know, I think carving out a role. But I think she's also showing that she is an effective attack dog. She's gotten under Donald Trump's skin in a way that few other politicians have been able to, and that's why you see him kind of sounding off and saying things like, well, she's got a big mouth, which again, of course, hurts him with women.
Because Trump doesn't, right?
Right. No, he's very demure, obviously. But I think it's interesting to watch her, and I'm watching her closely as, you know, somebody who might make it onto that VP list because she is so effectively, you know, hitting Donald Trump in a way that Hillary Clinton isn't as comfortable and doesn't come as naturally to her.
Now, there's been a little bit of trouble for other Democrats. Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe, he's a close ally of the Clintons. He has actually just pulled out of a fundraiser for former Ohio Governor Ted Strickland because he's being investigated by the FBI. What is that about?
So that was a story that my colleague Evan Perez broke on CNN. And essentially, they're looking at the campaign contributions of a Chinese businessman who gave about $120,000 to the McCullough for governor campaign. Now, that businessman is also he has permanent resident status. So they argue that he's able to give those kinds of campaigns. That businessman also gave money to the Clinton Foundation. And of course, Terry McAuliffe, very close to the Clintons. He's often described Bill Clinton as his best friend, and they were very supportive of his run for governor. So that's why this has national implications outside of Virginia, because of that close nexus to the Clintons and their foundation. And the feds are investigating where that money came from and whether it was legally given.
It's also this technicality that there's this the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which is about American citizens lobbying for foreign entities, and whether he's run foul of that technicality. But to Chris's point, this matters not just because Terry McAuliffe is very close to Clinton's, but let's not forget, you know, in previous elections, we've all been in Ohio for months and months of our lives. Virginia has become, because of demographic shifts and particularly the changing nature of Northern Virginia and lots of non-whites moving in, Virginia has become perhaps on a par with Ohio as a battleground state. Big state, lots of people, right on a knife edge between the two parties. So the Clintons were looking to Terry McAuliffe to be the kind of the general in charge of their fortress in Virginia.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to see how serious this gets. We have an email from Bridget in Oregon. She says, Hillary's use of private server was not illegal. It was discouraged, not prohibited. The press, even NPR, needs to get it right. What do you guys say to that?
It was prohibited. I mean, the rules when she came in were not to do this. In fact, it was such a unique arrangement that they didn't even cover private servers, because that's not something anybody had done before. But because it was personal email, it was in fact prohibited.
And also, politically, not illegal is a bad bumper sticker.
True. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Sabri Benishore with Marketplace filling in. And if you'd like to join us, call 1-800-433-8850 or send an email to drshow@wamu.org. You can find us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And don't forget, you can see all of us on our live video stream at drshow.org. I don't know if you want to see me in the morning ever. So let's go to we have a lot of Hillary calls. Let's go to Scott in Houston, Texas.
Hey, I do have a comment to make, and whether you go through the, if it's okay to have a personal server or not about the email, that's the choice she made to do her communications. What is more substantive now is we have to see what does the director of the FBI in his investigation determine about her knowingly having classified top secret information on an unsecure network. That is where we need to really, did she have a server? Yes. Was she allowed to? That's really not that big of a deal, because whether she was or not, she did it.
Scott, thank you. Thank you for that.
If she didn't know about classified information, we have a much larger problem here. And I think that's where we need to be looking at, as opposed to, because that's where legal ramifications could come in.
Sure. Scott, thank you. This is something that that has puzzled me a little bit, too. Everything that was classified, hasn't it been retroactively classified? It wasn't classified at the time, right?
Well, that's what Hillary Clinton says, and her campaign says. It wasn't classified at the time, and that afterwards there's this sort of rampant overclassification that goes through government. And a lot of experts agree with that there's stuff that is deemed classified and then therefore not released to the public. And, which is a whole separate issue that relates to this, that and it happens too much. But I do think the caller is right that the big question that's out there right now is, what's the FBI going to do? Are mm-hmm. they going to issue, obviously an indictment would be the worst possible scenario for her. So is that going to happen? And in order to do that, as I understand it, they have to show that she had some unknowingly put national security at risk, knowingly you put compromised classified material. And that is a very high bar to meet. So I'm not really sure whether it's going to really end there. But I think that is still obviously the the shoe out there that has yet to fall?
David?
Well, I think it's you've got two things going on. You've got the law, and the FBI is going to follow the law and take that decision. You have got this character issue. Now, I agree with everything we've sort of said before, that this isn't going to, you know, stop her becoming president when nothing else can, you know. But it does play into this problem of judgment. And I was talking to someone who works at the State Department at a pretty senior level, and I was talking to them privately and saying, if you did this, if you had done this, would you be in trouble? And they were like, yeah, this is why we're all paranoid about our emails and two different BlackBerries and stuff. We would have been killed if we'd done this.
Chris, very quickly.
In fact, the Kenyan ambassador did do this, and they started discipline proceedings against him while Hillary Clinton was doing the same exact thing.
Coming up, your calls and questions for our panel. Please stay tuned. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Sabri Benishor with Marketplace, sitting in for Diane Rehm. With me is Chris Freites. He's an investigative correspondent with CNN. David Rennie, he's Washington bureau chief and columnist at The Economist. And Laura Meckler, national political correspondent at The Wall Street Journal. Let's go to Derek in Talent, Oregon. Derek, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'm a Bernie or bust Sandernista. And, you know, Bernie said long ago that we were sick and tired of hearing about her damn emails, but that may be the case. But it does. The big reason, it seems to me, that she was trying to avoid a public server was because she could avoid public records request information, in particular FOIA requests, Freedom of Information Act. And we have to demand more of our elected officials and cabinet members that they play by the rules and make that stuff available so that when it is declassified or available to the public, that we can understand what they're doing.
Sure. And thanks, Derek. What do you guys make of that? Laura, go ahead.
Well, I think that in from my point of view, that's one of the most disturbing, if not the most disturbing parts of this whole email setup, is that it did, in fact, make it difficult for the public to find out what she was talking about over email. She has long said, well, she expected that her emails would be available because so many of them went to other people on their state.gov accounts. But the reality is that the way the State Department responds to FOIA is the way that information is made available. It's very, very hard to find them when they're all scattered throughout the government, and it should be easy. And one of the points that was made that was already known, but that was made by the Inspector General report, was that she did not archive them as she went along. She did not turn them in. In fact, when she left office at the end of her tenure, she did not turn them all over then. She did not do it until months later when she was asked. So I think that from a public records point of view, this is not perhaps criminal, but it is disturbing, I think, that, you know, that you do, when you work for the government, you know, your government business is public, and that's the way it is.
And
it should be.
And we are, again, just so everyone knows, we're going to have a whole show on this next week. So hang on.
Hold on to your hats.
Yeah. Chris, did you want to add to that?
No, I think Laura covered that. And I think the piece that, you know, I think needs to be emphasized is she did not turn these emails over until the lawyers started asking for them. And the Benghazi committee, which has been much maligned by Democrats, will point out that they're the ones who found out that she had this private email account. And that's how they were able to start making these requests. And that's when the State Department could be responsive, is they had to go to Hillary Clinton herself. That's how this all started. And without the Benghazi committee, Trey Gowdy, the chairman of that committee, would tell you we wouldn't even know she had this private server, because those emails existed nowhere in government records.
Now, Bernie Sanders has made clear there's a lot of all the conflict that you hear in the primary campaign is replicated behind the scenes. And Bernie Sanders has made clear that he wants to replace Democratic Party Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz. Is that going to happen? And what's happening in that conflict?
Well, it might happen. You know, she is a very divisive figure.
Why is that?
Well, because she just sort of never seems to use a scalpel when a mallet will do. she is been perceived by the Bernie people to be pro-Hillary in a variety of decisions. I'm not so sure whether she's made any actual decisions that have been biased, but she has come out on several occasions and essentially just tried to take down Bernie Sanders when she thought he was in the wrong on TV in a very sort of divisive way. Rather than trying to calm the waters, she tends to roil the waters. The Sanders people absolutely think she's got her whole hand on the scale in favor of Clinton. So I think that when the two parties inevitably start to try to talk after the voting is done and they talk about ways that they can come together, it's very possible that she may be on the table. There's a lot of people on the Hill who think that she would be a very good sacrificial lamb to try to bring the parties together.
David, go ahead.
And if there's listeners wondering why they should care who the current chairman of the DNC is and whether she goes before the convention or she was expected to go anyway by the end of the year because she's been DNC chairman for quite a while, here's why it really matters in the real world, outside kind of DC, inside the Beltway, is if she is weak and needs to make concessions to keep Bernie Sanders on board and to avoid having a kind of gigantically kind of argumentative convention, we can already see her doing things like giving him five members of the platform committee that will design the party platform. Now, you know, people very close, and you know, I have to be careful in the standards well off the record, but people very close to Debbie Wasserman Schultz have in the recent past been fairly dismissive behind closed doors about how much party platforms matter and how much of a real concession this is.
Right, and Bernie Sanders was given, he was able to appoint five people to the Democratic Party's platform.
Which is unprecedented.
Whereas normally a DNC chairman, if they want to play hardball, can just appoint everyone they want. Now, you can argue about how much a party platform ultimately matters because a presidential candidate isn't completely bound by what's in the party platform. And also, you know, frankly, most members of the public cannot quote the party platform to you. But we have seen at previous conventions party platforms become news because there's a gigantic divisive row about something like, in this case, people are now panicking about Israel-Palestine becoming an issue because at least a couple of the people that Bernie Sanders has named as his representatives on the platform committee, James Zogby, the pollster and Arab-American...
He's the brother of the pollster.
Oh, he's the brother of the pollster. I'm sorry. The Arab-American activist and Cornell West, the African-American history professor, they have both got a record of fairly stern comments about this Israeli government and the Middle East policies of the Democratic Party. So if that becomes a gigantic issue, then Debbie Wasserman Schultz's weakness, if it means that this gets more traction and TV viewers watch a gigantic row which sounds anti-Israeli, then you're into the world of real news as opposed to inside baseball.
Laura.
Well, I think that... I think that the reason why this also matters is because as Sanders, it's become apparent that he's probably not going to be the nominee. It's been the conversation has been, well, so where does he go from here? He obviously has a lot of energy that he cares very much about his issues. And one of the things that I've identified of where they're going to go from here is they're going to try to get their issues into the platform. They're going to try to get some changes into the rules that the Democratic Party uses to choose future nominees. And that's why it matters sort of who's on these committees. But really, at the end of the day, I think the most likely scenario is that the Clinton people are not going to care that much about the details of what's in the platform. They don't have maybe the Israel thing will blow up. That is one that has the potential for that. But most of the stuff, whether it's a $12 minimum wage or a $15 minimum wage, I would not expect to see a big fight about that.
And Jim Zogby is not some sort of, you know, flag burning radical. I mean, he's a very sort of center of the road person who doesn't say much that's different from what the State Department says.
And just Chris, to piggyback a little bit on David's point, which is, you know, well, why do people care, you know, outside of the Beltway? And I think because Debbie Wasserman Schultz is the chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee, she is part of that establishment that Bernie Sanders and his supporters really feel like are rigged. And if you go through their complaints, and you know, I've talked to Jeff Weaver about this, Bernie Sanders campaign manager, at length. If you go through those complaints, there weren't enough debates. You know, again, we're not debating in California. She had promised that there would be a California debate in May if this was still going. That didn't happen. You also look at, you know, of course, we're talking about the party platform, but when you know, Jeff Weaver gets on CNN and says, you know, well, Debbie Wasserman Schultz has been throwing shade at the Bernie Sanders campaign since we started. And then she responds with hashtag SMH, you know, shaking my head, and goes on to attack, you know, Bernie Sanders and his campaign. You can start to see why people think, as Laura pointed out, that might be a good sacrificial lamb to say, okay, you know what, Sanders supporters, we want to bring you in here. We're getting rid of that top of the ticket, that party figure, and we're going to bring in somebody who's acceptable to both of you, which is really unprecedented. And I think it is the establishment recognizing how much anti-establishment energy is in the party right now, and that they need to bring those folks into the fold, and they need to make sure that they come out and vote for Hillary Clinton and don't sit on those sidelines.
What do you all make of all the violence we are seeing, particularly at Trump rallies this season, from multiple sides?
So I've been at a lot of Trump rallies. More than two dozen Trump rallies. And the thing that has struck me is that, you know, there is a kind of underlying tension inside of those rallies. And it's twofold. One, you know, Donald Trump, you know, it loves to rile up the rallies. He's a showman. He loves when those protesters come out and, you know, get them out of here, go get a job, send them back to mommy. You know, are we having fun here, guys? We're having fun, aren't we? And people get all riled up and they love that. But it's also important to remember that those folks are coming in and they are agitating and they are upsetting what is a private event. Now, when they are outside, you know, that is certainly a space where they are legally protesting. And when they start to riot, as we saw, you know, this
throwing,
week,
burning T-shirts, plastic
west,
bottles.
Exactly. That is against the law. And that is, you know, that is essentially that gives Donald Trump the ability to say that these are criminals and they're coming to disrupt, when by and large, you're seeing big contingents because people feel very strongly against Donald Trump. But, you know, that kind of inside, it plays to Trump both ways. He gets to, you know, kind of incite it inside and then say they're breaking the law outside.
Well, it's still very dismaying wherever it's happening, the whole dynamic. David, go ahead.
I tell you what was also, if you're the Hillary Clinton campaign, I assume they were incredibly dismayed to see when there was some trouble in the streets of Albuquerque this week, protesters not only sort of smashing up a couple of police cars, but also waving Mexican flags. Because if you are Donald Trump's people, that is proof positive that his opponents are not proper Americans, they're not patriotic Americans, they're these foreigners. And there is a kind of unhealthy symbiosis between the most radical elements of the left, who know that it's provocative to wave a Mexican flag, but they don't care because they hate Trump so much. And if you're Trump, you know, you're delighted to see that. He tweeted it out. Mm-hmm. Look at the Mexican flags.
Yep.
These two groups are feeding on each other. And if you're the Clinton campaign, that's a nightmare.
Yeah. Laura, did you have anything to add to that?
No, not in particular. I think that, you know, the protest is a great American tradition in this country, and the strong passions at the Trump rallies are reflective of the very, very strong passions people have against Donald Trump.
I'm Sabri Benishore with Marketplace, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. So another round in the battle over transgender bathroom access this week. Who are the states suing the federal government over this, and why?
Well, I believe Texas is one of the lead states that is filed the suit. Other ones include Arizona, Georgia, Wisconsin. There are 11 total that are involved. Why is that? The federal government just issued guidance saying that in schools, public schools, you need to allow people to use the bathroom of their choice. If somebody identifies with a different gender from that which they were born with, they still should be able to use the bathroom that they choose. This is a very interesting issue, both legally and culturally. It's been just as we saw a rapid acceleration of the conversation about gay rights, you know, several years ago. I think we're now seeing that same conversation about transgender rights, and something that people were very uncomfortable with not that long ago has coming out into the mainstream, and people are grappling with it on both sides. The Obama administration has come down clearly on the side of civil rights for people who identify as transgender, and they point to the law which says which bars discrimination on the basis of sex,
which
and
is not totally defined yet.
Well, right, but that's so that's the question. Keep in mind that this is different than a discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, mm-hmm. which you know which has to do whether you're gay or lesbian. This is about on the basis of sex. Are you a man or a woman? Now, obviously, it's against the law to say, you know, we're going to provide bathrooms for men and not women here. Mm-hmm. But is it against the law to say that you have to use this bathroom, so or you're not allowed to use that bathroom? So that this isn't a part of the law that is being developed right now, but and that this case will test.
Do you think this will go to the Supreme Court, David?
You have to assume that that's where this is headed. I think what we also need to understand is that this is a proxy fight. This is the latest mm-hmm. round in a very long fight. And the reason that this is proving so contentious and, you could argue, such a useful wedge issue for conservatives who are, say, unhappy about gay marriage is, you know, why did gay marriage move so fast in terms of public opinion in such a short space of years? One of the reasons, I think, is that people, a majority of Americans, came to realize that it didn't actually harm them if gay people wanted to join this institution. It didn't really radically change the institution. I mean, clearly, some people think it does harm the institution. But enough people said, this isn't zero sum. It's just more people joining the institution of marriage. It doesn't take anything away from me. What this bathroom issue has done is it's given people who are generally unhappy about the pace of change in society, who think that the country is losing its kind of traditional religious Christian, Judeo-Christian values, it's given them a zero-sum issue, that suddenly these people who are making claims about their own rights as transgender people, that they're actually making your children less safe. They're making your children in danger. And so that's a really useful wedge issue to make it into an attack on decent, ordinary people who are now being threatened by these sick people. And I think one of the most dismaying things for me this week was seeing the Texas Attorney General, who's the lead plaintiff in this, essentially explain that he doesn't really take transgender claims seriously. He said, you know, these men could change their mind in a day. They could change their mind back and forth and decide they're a woman today and a man tomorrow. And I think that was a really revealing moment, because it showed that essentially what he's saying is he doesn't think that people who claim to be transgender should be believed.
Well, it shows that he doesn't know anyone who's transgender. Is what
well,
that
see.
Point.
Yes, and I think that that's a really interesting point. I think what changed attitudes about sexual orientation in this country was that a lot of people got to know people who were gay. As more people sort of came out of the closet, got to know them, then it wasn't so scary. And I think there are not that many people who know transgendered people. And if that starts to change, then I think the attitudes will follow.
Well, speaking of LGBT issues, that came up in Congress yesterday over a routine spending bill. It was quite a ruckus. What happened?
So this was a continuation of a fight that we saw last week on these must-pass spending bills. They often put on riders, and the Democrats wanted to put on a rider that said that federal contractors will not discriminate against LGBT individuals. And that amendment was killed last week. At the last minute, it had passed. The Republican leadership saw that it was going to pass. They kept the vote open. They twisted arms so that amendment failed without, and then the bill could pass without that amendment. What happened this week is enough Republicans stayed on that amendment to pass that amendment that then the entire bill failed, which was a big embarrassment to House Speaker Paul Ryan as he tries to, you know, make the case that we're following regular order and are, you know, are passing our nation's spending bill. So this fight is a multifaceted fight. And to Laura's point earlier, when you know, she's making this point about, you know, many people do not know transgender individuals, I think what we're seeing also from the opponents of that harkens back to what we saw the opponents of gay marriage and gay rights. They often made the pedophile argument that if gay men in particular are pedophiles and they prey on children. And there's an echo of that in the transgender bathroom fight, where they're saying, well, men are going to dress up as women to go into women's bathrooms and then to hurt your little girl. So we're seeing again an echo
of fear.
The specter of fear on this pedophile issue, which, you know, experts and folks who are gay, lesbian, and transgender will tell you, you know, certainly pedophilia is a crime. It's disgusting, and you should never prey on children. However, those echoes are back, and I think that is concerning to many people as well.
Right. Well, and also, you know, a majority of Americans believe that you can't discriminate against gay and lesbian people, but you, in fact, can nationwide. And here we have this this bill to prohibit that failed, at least among federal contractors. I'm Sabri Benishore with Marketplace sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Hey, thank you.